in my book, I don't really equate productivity with how much you produce. Mm-hmm. I equate it with how much you accomplish. And what that means is, you know, managing your time and also your attention and your energy better over the course of the day. Mm-hmm. And this is something that everybody knows that they need to do. And the reason for that, and the reason why there's so many articles out there, is that everybody has that sepia tone fantasy of being that guy or that girl who wakes up at 5:30 every morning and meditates and goes for a run and does yoga and reads the newspapers and has a coffee before the rest of the world has even woken up. Mm-hmm. But in the moment, you know, you want nothing less than that. You know, you want to sleep in for a few hours and grab McDonald's on the way to work. And so there's this gap. And this is what makes us human, for one thing, because it's what makes us emotional. But there's always this gap between what we intend to accomplish and what we actually accomplish. And that is the gap I think productivity is designed to bridge.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today's episode of the Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. I've never heard anyone rave about a hosting company the way Winnie from the Let's Talk Tech show did about HostGator. Here's what she had to say.
I've been a HostGator customer since approximately 2009 when I had a huge problem with my provider at the time. Their service and the information that this provider was giving me was bad, and my site went down for a few days. So I suddenly became a student of hosting and found HostGator. I made the switch very quickly. They made it super simple for me. And I have since become married to their brand. I adore them. And one thing that locked me into working with them and just made me overjoyed with them was several years ago when I was creating a site, a very simple WordPress-based site for a client at the time, a restaurant. And I got a call at about 4 in the afternoon from the chef, who was in a panic because his site was down. And I instantly got on support. You know, I called HostGator. And first of all, the fact that someone was there at 4 in the afternoon on a Saturday night just thrilled me. I was able to talk to an actual human, and the person stepped me through the problem and stayed on the line with me for 6 hours while we solved the problem. That level of dedication, service, kindness, and just treating me with the respect and dignity that I deserved as a professional just really made me so happy. I can't begin to describe it. Just saying I'm happy is not really enough. And whether I contact them through chat, through email, or dial up the phone, they are always there, always delivering me fantastic service, great value, and they're truly the only host to recommend to other people.
So if you haven't checked them out yet, visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off all hosting packages. And to get access to Chris's 26 productivity roadmap, which he mentions at the end of the episode, visit unmistakablecreative.com/roadmap. Now let's get to the show. Chris, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me back, man.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you back here. You know, we had you sometime last summer, actually, at the recommendation of one of our listeners, and you just packed that conversation with so many insights. But before we get into your work, can you tell us, you know, for our listeners who may not be familiar with who you are, a bit about your work, your background, and how that has led you to everything that you're up to now?
Yeah, for sure. Just kind of like a Coles Notes summary, because I don't want to go over everything again. And probably people aren't as interested as I think they are, or maybe you as well. But essentially, I graduated university in May of 2013 with a couple full-time job offers. And I decided, you know, if there was a time when I should explore my passion, which of all things, you know, some people are interested in normal things like sports and cooking and stuff like that, but I'm interested in productivity. And so I figured if there was a time when I could explore my passion, it was then. And so I made the decision to decline those jobs and start the Productivity Project. And, you know, for a full year, I experimented on myself. I ran dozens of productivity experiments on myself. I interviewed the most renowned productivity experts from around the world. And I also, you know, it was first and foremost this research project where I dove deep, deep, deep into the research and everything else, the books, the articles, all surrounding human performance in the workplace. And my book, The Productivity Project, is the result of that. That wasn't too bad. I summarized a lot in a very small chunk of time.
Yeah, you did. You know, one of the things that I've never done with anybody is actually look at the process of how something like this comes together. I'm really interested in how you decided on a research process, decided on a structure for a project like this, and then, of course, you know, how somebody might apply a similar framework to their own life. And then we'll actually get into the content of the book, which is phenomenal.
Oh, thank you. It was kind of half planning and half passion. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to plan it too much because I figured, you know, things change and the future is impossible to predict. But I figured, you know, anyone can do basic research, and research, writing about it is kind of boring. Reading about it's kind of boring. So I knew from the start I wanted to conduct these experiments and use those as kind of a springboard to look at these different topics, like living in total isolation for 10 days, meditating for 35 hours over the course of the week, you know, dozens of experiments like that. And that was kind of where I started with it, and I went from there because really, when I started the project, I didn't really know what I didn't know about productivity. And as the lessons began to shape in front of me, I started to recognize the things that I didn't know and began to know them as the project went on. Does that make sense?
I don't know. Yeah,
it's kind of like the different stages of learning. Mm-hmm. Like there are times when you know enough stuff to know stuff, but you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where I was at the start of the project. But thankfully, you know, even though I'd been researching productivity for 10 years up to that point, thankfully, the year-long project and the idea that it was full-time, it gave me that kind of sandbox that I could play around with these ideas inside of, which was, it was pretty fun.
Yeah, you know, I've always found having some sort of creative sandbox, you know, regardless of whatever your main work that you're doing is incredibly useful. Like I get so much from projects that seem to have nothing to do with my work.
Yeah, exactly. And the limitations that can spur creativity. I find that fascinating too. Again, you're probably more of an expert on creativity than I am, but I find it fascinating how limitations and constraints, you know, even though they limit how much freedom you have, they somehow unleash the amount of creativity you have with, you know, with exploring certain ideas. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So before we
get... What limitations do you set, by the way? Like, what kind of things do you do?
Well, I have a couple. I mean, one of mine is 1,000 words a day, rain or shine.
Yeah, yeah.
But like my mornings are like clockwork. There's no, you know, there's no variation of the first hour or two of my day. I mean, I've even gone so far at this point as doing something as ridiculous as buying 3 black shirts and just rotating those for a week straight, which I don't recommend to anybody.
You're the Steve Jobs of podcasts.
Which I do not recommend to anybody if you're dating another person. But seeing as the fact that I'm single and, you know, right now I'm in the midst of writing a book and more or less living in isolation, I don't care. it's actually one decision that I've eliminated from my day. Before we get into the book, I want to ask you a question about why productivity is such a nightmare of an issue for people. It's something that we all, you know, just want so much more of in our lives. And yet, I mean, I feel like every single day when I log on to Medium or any other website or I log on to Flipboard, maybe it's because all these algorithms are reminding me how not productive I am. But all I see is content about how to do things more productively. And I can't but help but wonder if we have a productivity epidemic on our hands.
I wouldn't put it that way, but I would say that people oftentimes don't realize how much more productive they could be. Mm-hmm. If you look at the average person out there, and I don't want to put down the average person by any means, but I'll try to be like positive in how I say this, but it's amazing how much room there is to become more productive. And this is something that I've slowly started to uncover. It's not like the most productive people are 10 or 20% more productive than the least productive people. It's like they're 10 or 20 times mm-hmm. more productive than everybody else. And as I've started to uncover that and interview these people, you know, there are some people who just sit around doing email all day long. And then there are other people who engineer products that change the world. So, you know, what is the gap that exists between those people? And I really think that gap is productivity. In my book, I don't really equate productivity with how much you produce. Mm-hmm. I equate it with how much you accomplish. And what that means is, you know, managing your time and also your attention and your energy better over the course of the day. Mm-hmm. And this is something that everybody knows that they need to do. And the reason for that, and the reason why there's so many articles out there, is that everybody has that sepia tone fantasy of being that guy or that girl who wakes up at 5:30 every morning and meditates and goes for a run and does yoga and reads the newspapers and has a coffee before the rest of the world is even woken up. Mm-hmm. But in the moment, you know, you want nothing less than that. You know, you want to sleep in for a few hours and grab McDonald's on the way to work. And so there's this gap. And this is what makes us human, for one thing, because it's what makes us emotional. But there's always this gap between what we intend to accomplish and what we actually accomplish. And that is the gap I think productivity is designed to bridge. It's impossible to achieve everything you intend to, you know, or else you'd be a computer or a robot, and that would suck even more than being a human. But, you know, I think that's where productivity kind of is supposed to fit in.
So we'll talk about bridging the gap, but I want to ask you one other question before we get into that, because I think that's what we'll spend the rest of our time on. How much of this do you think is inherently built into certain people? I mean, you mentioned that some people check email all day and some people create products that change the world. And I wonder how much of that is something that people are born with.
Is some of it, but you know, there's a quote, and I mentioned Steve Jobs when you were uh-huh. talking about your shirts and how disgusting it is that you don't shower and stuff like that.
I didn't say I didn't shower.
Oh, okay. So you do shower. Yeah. Okay. One of the experiments I did in my project was living like a total slob for a week where I didn't shower, uh-huh. didn't shave, and I ordered takeout every day. It's a lot like the writing process, I've found.
Yeah.
But there's a quote from Steve Jobs, and which I'm going to butcher now for everybody listening, that there are some people who you can never teach to work. And those people will always, you know, try to push work away and be unmotivated. And it's kind of a pessimistic view. But, I think there are some people who, you know, productivity won't work for them, but they're kind of the minority. I think there's room for everybody to improve, whether or not you're motivated or not. You know, the psychology behind it shows that there are some character traits that are correlated with, you know, procrastination, with being unproductive, like impulsiveness being a big one. People who are impulsive, that character trait is correlated with procrastination more than anything else out there. And so those folks might need to invest in mindfulness or something along those lines. But I really think that this capacity to change is inherent within everyone. You know, how difficult it is will depend on the person and how ingrained these things are. But I kind of take a more optimistic view than, you know, that Steve Jobs quote. Mm-hmm. I believe it a little bit, but I mostly don't. You know, when you find yourself opposite of Steve Jobs on an issue, you know, maybe you're wrong, but I take the optimistic view for that.
Yeah.
What about you? What do you think?
That's a good question. I think that there's spectrums of it, right? I think there's a degree of it. Like, I see certain people who I know have the capacity to do things that are just out of this world, and I know because I've interviewed so many of them. And then, you know, I see people who I think, actually, here's how I'll break it down for you, right? It's actually the way I look at it is there are three types of people who go to conferences, and I realize this isn't just three types of people who go to conferences. This is three types of people who attempt to make any sort of change in their life, right? Whether they read books, whether they listen to podcasts, there are people who wouldn't have needed the thing and just enjoyed it and would have made the change they were going to make regardless of whether they read the book, listened to the podcast, or went to the conference. There are the people who that thing could become the catalyst for, and then there are people who will go and look for the next thing. The next book, the next conference to go to, the next podcast to listen to, the next book to read, but they'll never actually do anything. And that's kind of the way I think about it.
Yeah, and then they're kind of consuming productivity porn at that point.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and a lot of people do this. You know, mm-hmm. some people read about productivity because they actually want to implement the productivity tactics.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is a much smaller number of people. At least, you know, this is the optimistic side of me talking. But you have other folks who read about productivity because you feel productive reading about productivity. and it's true. But the thing about productivity tactics, and the thing that's so easy to forget, is that for every minute you spend reading about productivity, you have to make that minute back and then some, or else you're just burning time reading about productivity and looking at productivity porn. And that's one of the things I found in my project, by the way, is there is so much productivity advice out there that doesn't work. You know, for the book, I don't want to pimp the book too much because I don't want to be that sleazy guy. But, you know, I picked 25 of, you know, the hundreds of things that I experimented with over the last decade that I think will actually help you make the time back that you spent on them and then some. But I think there's an equal sized book, you know, maybe even double the size of this one, of the stuff that didn't work that, you know, just wasn't worth writing about.
Huh. Well, let's do this. This is a perfect time then to get into the things that do work. I mean, I doubt we can cover 25 of them in an hour.
Probably not.
But let's get into the ones that do work because I will happily pimp the book because I got an early copy of it and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's phenomenal. I really, truly think it is one of the best productivity books I've ever read. And I've read a lot of them. I have had my own addiction to productivity porn. So,
yeah.
But let's get into this. I mean, there's so many different things. So you tell me, where do you want to start?
Well, first of all, thanks so much. That means a lot. You know, this is okay. I won't try to pimp the book too much, but I'm really proud of it. I think the best way to do this chat, because I want to help the folks who will buy the book and also the people who won't buy the book. Uh-huh. So, you know, try to cram as much in for the latter group of people, which is honestly probably bigger than the first group. I think a good place to start is that not all tasks are built equal. Uh-huh. And have you gotten to that chapter yet?
Oh, yeah.
First of all, have you read the entire book?
Yes, I have, from cover to cover.
Oh, wow. Okay. Most people that I chat with don't, so that's good. I think that's a cool place to start because a big mistake that people make when they invest in their productivity is they say, okay, I'm really into productivity, and they download a million to-do list apps and, you know, every app under the sun, and they don't take that step back to figure out what they actually want to become more productive on in the first place. And if you don't do that, then you're really just treading water, because you can become more productive on email all day long, or you could become the most efficient person in the world at watching Netflix. But, you know, those things don't really lead you to accomplish much at the end of the day. And that's what you're kind of left with, especially if you do creative work. And, you know, there comes a point where, you know, if you do creative work, you can't structure it to the hilts because, you know, it'll just be make you rigid. But, you know, there's some kind of stepping back that you can do that will help you out. And one of the insights that I got from my project, and it was during the experiment that I had to work 90-hour weeks for a month. And so, you know, people have this tendency when they have more work than they have time to do it in, to throw more time at the work that they have to do, as opposed to more energy or focus. And one of the curious lessons that I learned from that, and it's so obvious, so such an obvious piece of advice in hindsight, is that not all tasks are built equal. You know, you have the checking email and watching Netflixes of your life, and then you have, you know, engineering a product that will reach tens of thousands of people, or recording a podcast that can potentially help people out, or, you know, training the new recruits on your team so that you can help them level up and get more done every day, or automating the repetitive stuff in your work so you can level up further. And so there's really this chasm, I think, between the less fruitful tasks of your work and the tasks through which you accomplish the most. And so maybe a good place to start, you know, because most people, maybe some people, you know, might not buy the book, is take a step back, you know, with a pen and a sheet of paper and write down everything that you're responsible for in your work, you know, whether it's small, whether it's big, whether it's medium sized, you know, over the course of the month, what are you responsible for in your work? And then ask yourself, of all these things, which of these allows me to accomplish the most in, you know, every hour of time that I spend on it? Mm-hmm. And if you do this a couple times, you pick your first, your second, your third. Some people have four tasks that are super high return. These should become your focus for your work, the tasks that you should actually invest your time, attention, and energy into. But I've been rambling for a little bit. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's incredibly helpful. So helpful, in fact, that I had everybody on our team go through that exercise. And I will share mine just, you know, for the sake of anybody listening. You know, I realized, okay, I have a book coming out. We're trying to build an email list to a certain number of subscribers. So I thought, okay, there are three things in my day that I figured out that are way more valuable than everything else I do combined. And one is to write articles and guest posts for the blog that we have, conduct interviews with people like you, and then do any outreach work related to my book or work on my book. And that's it. There's nothing else that I have on that list. And when I realized that, I was like, okay, that's it. This is what my day should consist of.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's easy over time to, you know, let the other things flood in. So you do need to, you know, delegate that stuff. You do need to shrink it by limiting how much time and attention you spend on it. And there's parts of the book dedicated to that too. But my three are kind of similar. They're writing for my website, promoting this book, and speaking. You know, I do more and more talks here and there for around productivity. And so those are the three main things that I focus. And I'm fortunate I have a team as well that I can delegate things to. And you know, I try to shrink or eliminate everything else if I can. Like, email's a tough one. The email's so difficult to deal with because it often doesn't take much time, but it takes up a disproportionate amount of your attention. You know, you spend all day flipping between tasks, like, you know, doing important stuff like working on a podcast and then checking your email, and, you know, working on a talk and then checking your email, or working on a book and then checking your email. And what that does is it doesn't necessarily take a lot of time away from your other tasks, but it takes up a lot of attention from your other tasks. So, you know, it's important to shrink and eliminate those. But it's interesting how few tasks are the most important. And yeah, doing that for your entire team, it's one of the best things that you can do for their productivity too.
There's more of my conversation with Chris after this short message from our sponsors. You heard from Winnie at the beginning of the episode, and I can tell you from personal experience that dealing with a hosting company that doesn't have it together is an absolute nightmare. Just imagine that you've had a blog post that went viral, and suddenly your site goes down. That's just one of the many prices that you can pay for having an unreliable host. With HostGator, you get 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email to answer any and all of your questions. And they even have an easy-to-use website builder and can help with your marketing. And they also offer one-click WordPress installs if you want to design your own site. So visit HostGator.com and use the promo code CREATIVE for 30% off all hosting packages. Our other sponsor for today is TrueCar. There are probably a lot of different things you want to do with your life this year, and let's be honest, buying a car is kind of a pain because you go from website to website, dealer to dealer, and by the time you get home, you're so sick of looking around, you just want it to be over with. TrueCar shows you what others in your area have paid for a car. It's total transparency that enables you to determine the fair price for the vehicle you want to buy. So not only can you get a good deal, you'll no longer have to spend so much time in the car buying process. Just think about all those steps: pricing, going from dealership to dealership, website to website. And that means you can finally write the book you've been wanting to write, learn the language you want to learn, or even learn to cook. It's more time for the things that actually add meaning to your life. And TrueCar users save an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. So there's no hassles or headaches. It's how car buying was always meant to be. And there are over 10,000 dealers in the TrueCar certified dealer network. So visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app and start saving. TrueCar, never overpay. Now, back to my conversation with Chris. Let's talk about this idea of managing attention. You know, it's really interesting you bring that up, because by the time everybody's listening to this, they'll have heard Cal Newport's conversation about doing deep work. And one of the things that really struck me that he said was that task switching, even though it seems really harmless throughout the day, actually over the longer term, diminishes your capacity to do deep and meaningful work. And, I actually did something very drastic as a byproduct of that. I literally deleted every single social media app from my phone. I made the home screen incredibly minimal. And after 7 p.m., I block email, Facebook, and then social media. Like, I can't do anything. I literally just turn the volume down of the inflow into my life. But I'd be really curious to talk about, you know, and from your own perspective about this idea of managing attention.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. The idea behind the book that I is, you know, there's three ingredients that you combine over the course of each day to make you productive. And those are your time, your attention, and your energy. And the attention is the one that's often the most compromised. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, Cal's book is so important. It's why any book about managing your attention is so important, because we have less and less of it. Research by, I think it was Daniel Gilbert out of Stanford. I might get that wrong and it might be embarrassing, but I'm pretty sure it's him. He found that in any given moment, we only dedicate 53% of our attention to what's in front of us. And so we basically leave half of our attention on the table. And that's the average. There are some people who are well below average. Some people are well above it, like Buddhist monks. But if you have two people and, you know, person A dedicates 40% of their attention to what's in front of them because they're constantly multitasking, they can never dive into one thing deep enough, like Cal would put it, you know, they're spreading their attention across 1,000 different things instead of channeling it and lasering it at one thing that they step back to figure out that was important. And then you have the second person who single tasks, so they only work on one thing at one time. They create more attentional space around the work that's in front of them. And they create that space to channel all their attention onto that one thing. And maybe they focus on their work 90%. This is, I think, a mindset that has to change when it comes to productivity. You know, person A, who spends 40% of their attention on their work that's in front of them, compared to person B that spends 80 or 90% of their attention focusing on what's in front of them, person B is going to accomplish at least double in the same amount of time that person A would, probably more, because there are such great costs associated with multitasking. Multitasking feels incredible. And it's one of the most stimulating things that you can do for your brain. You know, just do cocaine and then multitask on a bunch of stuff and your brain will release so much dopamine, you won't know what to do with yourself. But study after study after study after study after study has shown that multitasking makes you less productive and not more productive, because there are such amazing costs associated with switching from one task to another to another. And these can absolutely destroy your productivity. And so not being able to dive into any one thing deep enough is one thing, but you have these other kind of ancillary costs that come with that. You know, that makes you less efficient. There are costs associated with switching between these tasks because it takes your mind time and attention to switch from one thing to another. And so managing your attention is huge. And, you know, to the point of it kind of being lost in the way the world works right now, the more you use your brain to work, the more you need to manage your attention and your energy. But so often, we only manage our time. You know, we have this kind of factory mindset. You know, it used to be that most of us worked on an assembly line in a factory, where the more time we spent in that factory, the more productive we were, because the more widgets we could crank out in the same span of time. You know, our energy didn't matter. We could show up hungover if we really wanted to because the tasks were so simple and so repetitive. Our attention didn't matter that much because the work was so tedious. It didn't involve much brain power. But today, you know, time is still important. We're never going to go back to only, you know, not needing time as long as we work around the schedules of other people. But energy and attention are just as important, because, and I hate the word efficiency when it comes to productivity. You know, as often as it's used, you know, the words efficiency and effectiveness seem just like so cold and so corporate, but there's no kind of better word for it in this case. Like, you work less efficiently if you bring less attention to the work that's in front of you, if you don't shut off distractions, if you try to multitask on 1,000 things at once, if you stay connected to the internet 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. I have a whole chapter in the book about disconnecting from the internet, because the studies show that you spend 47% of your time on the internet procrastinating, which is, it's insane. And so, you know, I managed to ship my book in, I think, 6 weeks ahead of schedule. And I can say almost certainly that it would have been late if I had stayed connected to the internet during the writing process. So, you know, managing your attention as well as your energy, I think, are huge.
So two questions come from that. How do you train the capacity to manage your attention and increase it over time?
And that's one of the things that I find fascinating, and you know, why there's kind of hope for people who fall on this side of the spectrum where, you know, they're dedicating 20 or 30% of their attention. I think it starts with disconnecting. So, you know, eliminating those distractions, those temptations in the first place, because then you don't really have to expend any willpower trying to regulate your behavior. But what I find more fascinating, and this is kind of the harder route, but it's the more worthwhile route, is that it's possible to train how much control you have over your attention, to go from 53% of your attention dedicated to what's in front of you to 63 to 73 to 83 to 93. It's impossible to boost that executive functioning that you have. And one of the best ways, and you know, I'm going to use the M word, is mindfulness. Mm-hmm. But believe it or not, and so many people shut off when they hear that word, which is why it's so hard to write a business book these days, because it's so essential to working in a modern environment. But all mindfulness is continually bringing your attention back to the work that's in front of you, so that you can spend your attention in the present moment and not in the past or the future. Our mind is often straddling the three different places at once. It's kind of like, you know, at those places in the United States where you can stand on one point and be in three states at the same time. That's where we sit with the past, the present, and the future. You know, we're trying to work, but then we remember the stupid thing that we said earlier in the day, or we're trying to work and then we suddenly remember something that we have to do later in the day. But really, the only thing that's important in that moment is what's in front of us. And that's all mindfulness is doing, is every time you bring that attention that you have back to the work that's in front of you, back to the present moment, to what's in front of you, you heighten how much executive functioning that you have. So you train your, I call it an attention muscle because it's such a, you know, it's a natural kind of metaphor. You train that attention muscle that you have so you're able to bring more attention to the work that's in front of you in the moment. There's also meditation, which is basically mindfulness from concentrate, is how I like to think of it. And people make it out to be way more complicated than it actually is. and it's so true. You can do 5 minutes a day and that'll be enough to help you out. And really all it is sitting somewhere with your back straight. And every time your mind wanders off to something that isn't your breath, you bring it back to your breath. That's it. And people like to complicate it. And, you know, you think about the practice and you think, okay, why the hell is that so hard? But then you try it and you get discouraged. But that's kind of the point. You know, mindfulness, just creating that attentional space around the work that's in front of you in the moment and continually bringing your attention back. That's what kind of performs these repetitions of that attention muscle that you have.
Yeah. I mean, I'll go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry to interrupt, but you know, a good place to start with that is, you know, I don't want to talk all preachy and not give people tactical advice at the same time is, you know, carve out just 20 minutes, you know, someday this week to totally disconnect and work on one thing. So pick one of those three important tasks that you have in your work and schedule just 20 minutes, set a timer on your phone, then flip it into airplane mode and disconnect on your computer too. And when you're done, when those 20 minutes are over, observe how much you actually got done during that time, because that's really all you're left with at the end of the time that you spend is what you accomplish. It's not how busy you are. You know, you can be busy all day long and not accomplish a single thing. But productivity is about the results that your actions lead to. Mm-hmm. And I think you would be incredibly surprised at the end of those 20 minutes at actually how much you get done.
Yeah. So I'll share something that bears repeating. And we talked about it on our, 2015 wrap up episode. We had Susan Piver, who is a meditation coach here. And my favorite thing that she said is meditation is not a life hack. And I thought true. You know, I think that we often look at it as a means to an end when the point of the practice is the practice. Like once you realize that, you're kind of like, that's it. That's what I'm supposed to do. Like, I think people get this idea that they're doing it wrong or that they're screwing it up. And it's kind of like, no, not really. You're just annoyed because you think there's some way that you're supposed to do it.
When I started meditating, I was thinking like, okay, is this it? Am I doing this right? Yeah,
exactly.
Like, is really all I have to do sit here and keep bringing my attention back to my breath? Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how it's like communism. It's like so simple and beautiful in theory, but it's in practice is just hell. Like your mind goes to every state under the sun. It gets bored.
Yeah.
And then you want to just walk up and go away. It gets frustrated. Then you get pissed off. And then you ride that wave down into some sadness. And then you think, okay, why the hell am I sad right now? And then you go get to this bliss state because you observe the natural fluctuations of your mind. Uh-huh. You know, it's not often that it's not that meditation makes your mind busier or that it lets it fluctuate more. It's that you actually notice how much it fluctuates over the course of the day. You know, you experience those same fluctuations over the course of the day, but you're caught up in them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like being in traffic. You know, being in traffic, you experience, and I'm coming up with this analogy on the fly, so it might go to hell in the middle of it. But when you're in traffic, I don't even drive, so that's the weird part. When you're in traffic, I do take Ubers, you experience the fluctuations. Sometimes you're on a beautiful country road and the sun is shining and birds are chirping and you're driving, you know, 10 or 20 over and life is beautiful. There's no cars in front of you or behind you for miles. And some days the roads are slippery. And other days, you know, there's a traffic jam and, you know, there's a million cars on the road and you don't know what to do with yourself. Meditation is a process of, you know, getting out of that car and being on an overpass overlooking all those conditions as they change. Because the mind doesn't stay still. It fluctuates, and I don't want to get a hippie and Buddhist-y on you, but it fluctuates between these states over the course of the day, between sadness, between frustration, between guilt is a big one that I have that my mind likes to experience for some weird reason, to happiness, to excitement. It's a process of just noticing is all mindfulness is. And what happens when you only do one thing at one time is that creates the conditions to notice, you know, where you're at or what you're thinking about where you're at. And it also creates the conditions for, you know, maybe more pertinent to the subject of the podcast, you know, for creativity, because attentional space breeds creativity. It's like, you know, there's two modes that your mind fluctuates over the course of the day between. It's like a seesaw seesaw. Teeter-totter is a seesaw, right? Mm-hmm. Are they the same thing?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, your mind, okay, good. Your mind is like a seesaw and it goes between these two states over the course of the day. There's the central executive mode, which is a name neuroscience is called, the mode where you're constantly thinking about something. And so that's what you experience when you're on your smartphone. And then there's the mind wandering or daydreaming mode, which you experience when you're in the shower. And the difference between them that I kind of see as most important to productivity, to creativity, is how much attentional space you have in both of them. You know, when you let your mind wander and daydream, you create the space for ideas to bubble up and rise to the surface. That's why you have a brilliant idea when you're taking a shower and you've never had a world-changing insight when you were focused on your smartphone. And that's another reason to single task and focus on one thing at one time, because you create the conditions for that to happen. And also spend actually some time daydreaming as opposed to working faster and harder and more frantically. And that's honestly where I think a lot of people miss the mark when it comes to productivity is they say, okay, I'm really into productivity now. And they download all the apps and they work faster and harder and they push themselves and they end up hating themselves at the end of the day. Whereas, you know, real productivity should not only let you accomplish more, but actually let you feel good about it. And, you know, spending time daydreaming and creating that space. It's tough at first, you know, because of how ingrained multitasking is and actually how exciting and, you know, engaging it is. But single task is more rewarding over time.
So I want to talk about accomplishing our goals and the things that we want to do over the course of the day, because I remember you broke this down into the concept of three, and I want to dive deeper into this because this really has helped me a lot. You know, I have this in an Evernote where, you know, the top three goals for the week and when the day is over, what three things will I want to have accomplished. So I want to talk about that, and then I want to talk about a concept that This was the one that kind of got me, and I really wanted to have you back here to talk about it, was the idea of your future self and how that plays into all of this productivity. So let's do a deeper dive into those two things.
Cool. Yeah. Start with the rule of three.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the rule of three, again, it goes to the whole app thing, right? Mm-hmm. The weird approach to productivity. Some people I know, they have these systems where they spend like an hour every day organizing everything that's on their plate. But the problem with that, especially when you equate productivity with what you accomplish, is that for every minute you spend organizing everything, that's 1 minute you don't spend doing everything. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge cost and, you know, can make you less productive even though you feel more productive. And the rule of three is great because it aligns what you spend your time, attention, and energy on over the course of the day with how much you accomplish. And the rule of three is simple. Like, and you already said it. It's so simple. You know, you said it in the question, and I don't even have to say it in the answer. But at the start of every day, you mentally fast forward to the end of the day and ask yourself, you know, when the day is done, what three main things will I want to have accomplished? And it does a lot of things at once. You know, it's not that you don't keep a to-do list because, you know, there's still the minutia of daily life that you have to manage and control and do. But it lets you take that step back to form some intentions for what you want to accomplish. And that's one of the lessons that I learned over the course of the Productivity Project is that productivity isn't about doing more faster. It's about doing the right things, uh-huh. You know, the three most important things or four, deliberately and with intention. And so, you know, at one time, the rule is so simple. It takes a few minutes every day. But most importantly, it lets you care about the things that you have to spend time on or want to spend time on. And it fits with the way we think for some reason. And I haven't been able to get to the bottom of this, but for some reason, our brain is wired to think in threes. You know, we have things like the three Olympic medals. We have the three little pigs, the three blind mice, the three musketeers, Goldilocks and three bears. You know, we divide stories into three parts. We have the beginning, the middle, and the end. And the list goes on and on and on. So it meshes with the way we think, but it also works because, you know, it's that gap between what you intend to accomplish and what you actually accomplish that exists in everyone. Because when the day starts, it often doesn't matter what intentions you set at the beginning of the day when shit hits the fan over the course of the day and you forget what you wanted to accomplish. And the rule of three is important because it lets you keep in mind those three main things. So you won't be able to remember a whole laundry list of things that you have to do, but chances are you'll remember three. Mm-hmm. And it also lets you decide what you don't spend time on when you decide what you do spend time on. And, you know, maybe one last benefit, you know, there's so many benefits to a rule so simple. It's kind of like the meditation of productivity tactics. It's so simple, but, you know, it's kind of an art in practice, is that it lets you consider the limits that you have. And so at the beginning of the day, when I choose these three daily intentions, you know, I look at my calendar and look at the constraints that I have. And so these days around the book launch, and I'm sorry for pimping my book so much, by the way, but that's kind of like in the mode that I'm in. It's the state my mind is in. I'm really not this greasy in regular life, I promise. But, you know, it lets you look at the constraints that you have over the course of the day. And so you can look and say, okay, crap, I have five interviews today that I have to do if you're somebody who does interviews. And okay, think that you're okay, my intentions need to be a bit smaller today because I have less time to do those. Or maybe the intention is to rock those interviews and that cue comes up when you look at your calendar. But it also lets you adjust over time. So, you know, at the start, you might way overshoot those three things and accomplish way more than them, but then you set your sights too high and then you kind of come up short. Mm-hmm. And that's another, I think, huge thing when it comes to this rule is over time, as you adjust up and down and up and down, you find this equilibrium for how much potential you have to get stuff done every day, which I think is huge when it comes to not only becoming more productive, but understanding how productive you can be. Because I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make when they invest in their productivities. They're hard on themselves in the process. And this is something I fall into constantly. When I have more on my plate than I have time to do it in, I push myself harder and I'm harder on myself because of that. But I think that productivity, when you do it right, and this is what I found, actually does the opposite, and it lets you be kinder to yourself as you invest in your productivity. And finding the limits that you have to get stuff done is a way of doing that.
So let's get into this idea about your future self and why that plays a role. Because that was one part I was really, in some ways it was confusing, in some ways it made a lot of sense, but I wanted to, that was the one question I was like, I need to ask Chris this, and that's the one reason I want to, that among many other reasons, but this one question is why I want to get him back.
This is the only reason.
Yeah, I'm invited, the only reason I brought you back, just so I get an answer to this one question.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of the future self is that, you know, say somebody rolled up a brain scanning machine to you right now, and they asked you to think about you in the future. So maybe what your life will look like a year or two down the road from now, and say Taylor Swift or I'm so bad a celebrity. What's like a male celebrity?
Justin Bieber.
Do you know any? Justin Bieber. They asked you to think about Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber, and maybe together at last, as they are meant to be. The two brain scans, which is fascinating, wouldn't look all that different. In fact, they would look almost identical because the research shows that we think of our future self as no different from a total stranger. And what this means, and this is especially important when it comes to procrastination, is that since we think of ourselves only in the future as a stranger, and we have this disconnection with ourselves in the future, we are more likely to put stuff off because we aren't connected with the version of ourselves down the line that is going to have to actually do that work. And this, I don't know if that makes sense, but like this is why we say, okay, I'm totally going to watch these 5 documentaries on Netflix. And then we keep putting it off until tomorrow for our future selves to do, even though ourselves in the future wouldn't be all that different from ourselves now. It's why we give ourselves more work to do in the future. It's why we say yes to coffee to somebody that we don't want to have coffee with a month from now, because, you know, we think, okay, well, I'll be able to deal with this later when we won't be all that different when we're there. It's why we, you know, save less money for retirement. You know, they've done this guy, Hal Hirschfeld. He conducted an amazing experiment, and he worked with professional animators to put people in a studio somewhere. And I forget the specifics of the experiment, but the general idea is this. And he projected those people up onto a screen so they could see themselves in the future talking. And then they had themselves allocate, you know, $1,000 between their present day self and themselves when they retire. And the people who saw themselves, their future self, allocated way more money to themselves in the future because they were more connected with that version of themselves. And they realized that they were essentially the same person. And so I find that idea fascinating, because if you're a type of person who procrastinates quite a bit, this tactic isn't for everyone. You know, some people are really in touch with their future self and don't have a lot of this discontinuity. But, you know, doing simple things like, there's an app called Aging Booth, which lets you see a version of yourself maybe 30 or 40 years from now. I uploaded a picture of myself to the website for my book, which we can put in the show notes. Or even, you know, doing something as simple as writing a letter to your future self. They're simple tactics, but the easy act of imagining yourself in the future, or writing a letter to yourself in the future, or seeing some weird mock-up of what you'll look like down the road, lets you procrastinate less if you do have that disconnect.
Wow. So let's do this. One of the things I think that will happen is that you've packed a lot of information into one conversation, and I
think
know
it's
this,
too much. Yeah.
Well, I know this because I know it's my own temptation. When I sit down and I read a book like yours, I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm going to overhaul my life. So let's talk about how people start to implement this in a way that actually sticks.
Yeah. And that's the hard part. And that's what I find difficult about a lot of the books about productivity. And, you know, Getting Things Done is a book that you know, is one of the first productivity books I read. And I jumped in too much. I jumped in too deep. And I failed, because when you try to make changes that are too drastic, once your initial motivation to make those changes wears off, you're going to revert to the same habits that you had before. And that's why one of the things I did with this book is put together a roadmap that, you know, and some people like these kinds of things, like a roadmap. It's a 26-week timeline, essentially, of how to put these tactics into practice, because there's 25, you know, big tactics in the book that are on this roadmap. And, you know, even if a roadmap isn't your thing, I think taking that time to step back and think about which tactics you actually want to do and which ones you don't want to do, because, you know, why be hard on yourself in the process? But B, you know, forming these intentions that are not necessarily on the short term, or, you know, in the moment, like when you single task in the short term, when you do the rule of three, or in general, when you step back to figure out what's important, but kind of on a half a year or a year long time frame, because the important part, and these tactics won't pay dividends if you don't continue them in the long term. It's like making changes to the way you eat, right? Like the best diet in the world is the one you already have, with one minor incremental improvement, because once your initial motivation dies off, you'll still have the motivation to keep going because the habit change will be so small. And so I think that's kind of where I'd recommend people starting. You know, take a look at this roadmap that we put together. It's really fancy, to be honest with you. I sent it to my publisher and I said, hey, you guys mind designing this roadmap? And they came back with this beautiful looking thing. I'm looking at it right now. That has, you know, a recommendation for putting these things into practice. But, you know, even if, you know, that's kind of not your thing, and, you know, some people might dig this, some people might say, you know, okay, I don't want a step-by-step plan, you know, I kind of want to do it myself. You know, forming these medium-term intentions for how you want to do this, while soaking in the stuff in the book or in the podcast, you know, if you don't buy the book, I think is something that you should do. Does that help? I don't know if helps.
Yeah, that helps tremendously. Okay. Well, Chris, this has been phenomenal. I really appreciate you coming back. You know, for those of you listening, I will honestly say this is hands down one of the best productivity books I've read, and I've read a lot of them. So we'll be sure to link it up in the show notes and also send it up via email. So Chris, I'm going to ask you what I asked you last time as my closing question.
I forget what this question is.
What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think intention. You know, there are some people who live and work on autopilot in response to the work that comes their way. And there is another group of people, a much smaller group of people, who has intentions behind their actions, who take a step back, figure out what's important, and work with that intention. You know, intention is, it's my favorite word in the English language. And I think it's what makes us human. You know, dogs don't live with intention. They live, you know, responding to the cues in their environment. But intention is what makes us a unique kind of species. I think that's what makes us unmistakable.
Awesome. Well,
is that the same answer I gave last time?
I don't think so. I have no idea, but I don't think so.
I don't know either.
Well, you have absolutely packed this with incredibly valuable insights that are actionable. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and come back and talk about this with our listeners.
Thanks for your kind words about the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
So really I want to share my story to tell people that, you know, if life does take a detour, you got to follow that detour and just be open to see where it leads, because you really don't know what you'll get on the way. I think I'm past the point of thinking about, although I did for a long time, you know, if my life had gone this way, I would have done this and this and been on Broadway and done this. I would have. and I wouldn't have had an ostomy now and dealt with all this medical stuff and had a lot of pain and loss. But it's those twists and turns that have made me who I am today. And I think the, you know, the paths are so interwoven at this point that it really has made me who I am, and I couldn't give it back.
Amy Ostreicher joins us to talk about her amazing recovery from what seemed like a life-threatening illness.